Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Americans use the internet to buy more than 20% of clothing and electronics. They are less comfortable shopping online for groceries. Alana Samuels wrote about online grocery shopping for The Atlantic. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So in South Korea, 1 in 5 consumers buy groceries online. In the U.S., just 3% of groceries are sold online. What's the difference?
People really just don't like to shop online for groceries here. I mean, I think part of it is that it's harder for the companies to get groceries to you, so it's a little bit expensive. But people also just don't trust other people to pick out their produce, and they like, you know, getting out of the house and going to the grocery store in a lot of cases. I mean, this is different in cities where it can be really hard to go to the grocery store and then lug your groceries by foot. But if you're in a suburb or a rural area, it's actually not that big of a deal to drive to a grocery store, go in and pick your own stuff out.
And it's not that big of a deal in Korea?
I think in Korea, it is a big deal. And so people, you know, prefer to buy their groceries online. I mean, I think in South Korea and Japan and the UK, these are places where a lot of the population is centered around cities. Mm-hmm. So people in cities don't like grocery shopping in the store. So that's where you're seeing a lot of people ordering groceries online. In rural places like the U.S. or that are more rural or suburban, people are still pretty hesitant to buy groceries online.
Listeners, we're interested in hearing your stories. If you usually shop online for your groceries, give us a call and tell us what you think about it. 614-292-8513. In your piece for The Atlantic, you profiled the online grocer Peapod, which has been around since the early 2000s. How does Peapod reflect the larger industry?
It's really interesting because this is a company that's really just been trying to perfect this for a long time. You know, they started it when a lot of people didn't even have the internet, and they're still just having a lot of trouble getting people to shop online. You know, people, they have to offer a lot of discounts, a lot of coupons, a lot of incentives. And even then, even though they've been doing this for decades, they're still really trying to get costs down. They measure how fast their drivers go. They measure how many seconds their drivers take between stops, how long they're up in the apartment, still dropping off the groceries. So, you know, after decades, they're still trying to get costs and time down. And like many other grocery delivery companies, they haven't quite figured that out.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about shopping for groceries online. My guest is Alana Samuels. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic. We'll post a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org. But large tech companies are still investing in U.S. online grocery operations despite these slow starts. Why is that?
Well, I think for Amazon in particular, Amazon wants to be the everything company. They want you to sign up for Prime and get everything, you know, from TV to groceries to household necessities on Amazon. So they need to offer groceries because it's kind of another piece of their pie. You know, grocery is a very low margin business. Most grocery stores don't make a whole lot of money. But for a lot of these grocery stores, if they don't start offering online or more tech-friendly options, they're going to lose out to someplace like Amazon. So it's a kind of lose if you do, lose if you don't, because if they, you know, the more a Walmart or a Target offers groceries online, the more it's going to cost them. But if they don't offer it, they might lose customers. So you're seeing this competition for a not very appealing market.
You wrote that the most efficient grocery delivery companies are logistics companies. Why is that significant?
Well, you know, grocery delivery has so many different aspects to it. I was really surprised once I started looking into this, what a pain it really is. I mean, first you have getting the groceries packed for the individual orders. So they have to figure out how to be really efficient. And, you know, it's not like an Amazon where they can just throw a bunch of things into a box. Things have to be kept at different temperatures. Certain things are heavy. Certain things will get crushed. So they really have to figure out how to do that efficiently. And then there's the delivery itself. And, you know, an organization like a UPS or a FedEx has spent years figuring out how to make the most efficient routes between stops. You know, limiting left turns can save millions of dollars. So these grocery companies that have really just been about kind of figuring out what food people want and how to get it are now having to figure out what's the most efficient way to drive a truck to get this food to different neighborhoods. And that's where a lot of the costs come down.
Let's see. Rick in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Ann. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
We use a green bean delivery service for our produce, and they deliver once a week, fresh produce, milk, eggs, things like that. We use another outfit for all of our paper supplies, toilet paper, paper towels, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
We buy whatever we can online. And then when we do have to go to Kroger's, we order it the day before and then go in the morning and stay in the car, call from out there, and they bring it out. And that way, when I get sent to the store, I'm not buying the wrong thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get the phone calls, you know, three every time I send somebody to the grocery store. But why do you prefer that, Rick? You've got a system going. What's the appeal?
Time. Hmm. Time. There's just no time.
Or it creates time for you. It saves you time. You have time to do other things then.
Exactly.
Huh.
Exactly. So instead of spending an hour at Kroger's, you have the same shopping list from week to week, generally,
mm-hmm.
with just a few little adaptions. And it all works out. We're finding it great.
Yeah, I would say one of the things that Rick points out, one of the things that these online services like Peapod are really proud of is like Rick said, you basically have the same order from week to week. And so you log on to these platforms, it will say, you know, you have these essentials. Maybe you get a certain type of cereal and rice every week or every month. It will remember that. So you don't have to go through this whole list and choose, I want this, I want this. It will remember your favorites. And that just makes things a lot easier for people. And then it's good for brands too, because they can say, hey, we know you buy Cheerios every week. Would you like a coupon for this?
Let's see. Kathy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I love online shopping. I have it delivered from the store to my door. I just started doing it on a fluke, and now I do it all the time. I think that if you buy a case of Coke and a case of Pop, you take it off the shelf in the store, you put it in your cart, you take it out of your cart, you put it on the belt, you take it out of the belt, put it in your car to go home, you get home, you take it out of your car and take it in the house. Now I just open my door, and they bring it in and put it where I want it.
You said you started it as a fluke. What did you mean by that?
I was sick and didn't feel well, and I thought, oh, I need groceries, and it was bad out, and I didn't want to go out, and I decided to try it, and I've been doing it ever since.
How long have you been doing it?
Probably 6 or 8 months.
Do you do, like Rick, buy different things from different places?
No, I use one store.
Mm-hmm.
I did get the app for the other store, but I haven't used it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. People say that they don't like other people to pick out their produce, but you go to a restaurant and they pick out your meat and your salad, and you never see you never see the kitchen.
Well, that's a good point.
You just begin to eat it. So I've had really good luck with fresh produce and with meat.
Huh?
It saves you time. You don't have to park. You don't have to stand in line. And I think I really save money because I don't buy impulsively. I don't see a display for cookies or some new thing and pick it up because I don't see it.
Huh. Kathy, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Does that sound familiar, Alana Samuels?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting because my opinion is that once people start shopping online for groceries, they're really going to like it and they're going to start doing it more. But there's something that's just preventing people from doing it. And, you know, if you look at kind of why people adopt technology, there are always these early adopters who do something. And then as the word gets out and as they tell people it's reliable, it really catches on. And so it sounds like that's kind of where we are right now. People who try it like it. Other people just for whatever reason don't try it. I mean, I'd be curious. I think for the listener who said it saves her money because she's not buying impulsively,
yeah.
I think that's definitely true. I wonder to the degree to which, you know, she has to pay per order.
Fee for that. And I also was interested in Rick's the strategy for Rick of going one place for dry goods, going another place for you know, vegetables, and going another place for, you know, the canned goods kind of a thing.
Yeah, I mean, the grocery stores would hate to hear that. They want to be
everything. Yeah,
especially Amazon. Yeah, but I would say, you know, what he said about driving up to a Kroger and having them bring it out to the car. That's the thing that a lot of these old kind of more traditional grocery stores are trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they know it's going to be really hard for us to become logistics companies, but we can pack orders in the store and bring it out to your car. And you're seeing almost all the stores offering that now.
Okay, so Norma in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Norma. You have a different point of view on this.
I'm concerned about how we've gradually been destroying community ties and our sense of neighborhood, and becoming like more distant from our neighbors. And one of the places I meet my neighbors is at the grocery store, and I meet the people that are at my local grocery store, and I see people, and I can talk to people. It's a social occasion. Not in a great degree, but it's one of the few places that you kind of bump into people from your neighborhood.
Yeah, and that and the farmer's
like
market,
personal.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, farmer's markets, but my local Kroger, I mean, there's people who just go in to talk to the guy. You check out your own bags, but the guy who's kind of overseeing things, he's talking to everybody, like they're old friends. They come in and chat with him.
Mm-hmm. You know, it does sound a little bit like a dark, black, or is it Black Mirror or Dark Mirror? I can't remember now. They haven't come out with their new season yet. Alana Samuels, I mean, we're going to be separating from each other more and more and more.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Are you there, Alana? We're looking for Alana.
Yeah, I would also say if you look at the stores, even the stores that, like, say, Amazon is creating, I live in San Francisco and they just opened an Amazon Go store.
Oh, right.
So this is the kind of store you walk in with your app and you go in, you pick something off the shelf and you walk out. You don't interact with anyone. So I think that's definitely true that we're seeing, people go towards this kind of either stay at home and don't interact with anyone or even out in the world. Don't interact with anyone. I mean, I think the one thing I would say is if you live in a city, a big city, I don't think that you necessarily have that sense of community at the grocery store.
Huh.
But I get the listener's point that in a lot of communities, it's a great place to meet people. And the Amazons and Walmarts of the world are certainly making it harder to be a small business no matter what you're doing.
I wonder if this trend toward online grocery shopping is kind of butting heads with the other trend of going local, buying local, that whole culture that, granted is probably for the relatively privileged, but still.
Yeah, I mean, you do see some companies trying to bridge the gap. So there's a company in California called Good Eggs, and it delivers produce from a local farm to homes. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to kind of connect the local with the delivery. But I think it's going to be very hard to manage. And again, it's going to be probably for the people who are wealthier and have more money to spend on kind of conscience soothing things.
Well, Alana Samuels, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Alana Samuels is a staff writer with The Atlantic. She wrote about online grocery shopping. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Farmers are facing labor shortages. There are fewer seasonal laborers available coming from Mexico, and Americans don't want to do the challenging work. Faced with this challenge, tech companies are working to fill the gap. But the challenge is building a robot that can delicately pick the crop without crushing it. Joining us by phone is president of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee in Toledo, Valdemar Velasquez. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Washington Post labor reporter Danielle Paquette, who wrote about these machines. We'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org. Danielle, welcome.
Happy to be here.
You saw these harvest robots up close picking fruit. Tell us what you saw.
So one of these machines is programmed to do the work of 30 people. You know, it straddles about a dozen row of plants at the same time, and it picks about 5 strawberries every second while covering 8 acres a day. The challenge, as you note, it's hard to do this work with fruit that is delicate. This robot can drop it, it can squish it, and as of now, people in the fields are far more effective.
Yeah, so it wastes more than it collects, even though it can technically do the work of 30 people.
That's right. You know, researchers in Florida have been honing this machine over the last few years, and they make progress every year, but they're still quite a way behind the people who've been out there doing this kind of work for the same way for centuries.
Are strawberries sort of like the baseline? If you can pick a strawberry, you can pick anything else?
Oh, yeah. You know, this is a fruit that can damage so easily, and consumers want their strawberries not to be bruised. If you grab them too firmly, they almost immediately start going bad. So that delicate touch is so important to these businesses who understand that they need to quickly get these things on the shelves and in good shape.
Is there really a labor shortage? Is that what's really driving this? Or is it just yet another realm of commerce that technology wants to automate?
You know, farmers I hear from say it's just getting harder to fill these jobs. I'd love to hear more from the labor perspective, of course, and that people in general fewer people in general just want to do the work. I'm hearing that we're relying more on seasonal worker visas. You see those requests going up over the last 5 years or so. And that kind of labor force is in a precarious position because we have the Trump administration tightening its immigration policies.
So, Baldomar Velasquez from the Farm Labor Organizing Committee in Toledo, what are your thoughts about this? What do you know about it, and are you seeing this anywhere in Ohio?
Well, everything that's been said is true, and I'm quite familiar with the mechanization of other hand harvest crops. The cherry industry, for instance, in northern Michigan some years ago, and then the tomato industry. We never thought that machines could handle tomatoes, even for processing.
Mm-hmm.
But they did, and even got the. But these still needed workers on the mechanical harvester to sort the green ones and the bad ones out from the red ones. And then they came up with this electronic eye, and then makes the distinction itself. So technology is going to progress, and I don't have a problem with mechanization. It might sound strange coming from somebody like myself who represents laborers, but I don't romanticize that work. Maybe it's work the machines ought to do. It's backbreaking, and it's bad. The question here is that do the workers have a transition and make demands on the industry, like many farmers are trying to diversify to get out of labor-intensive crops into other crops that are machine-intensive. So there's a lot of changes going on, and we have to keep up with the best ways to represent the people. We represent 10,000 of those guest workers from Mexico to fill that labor void that the workers you can't get in the U.S. And even if you could get workers in the U.S., nobody that lives in the U.S. wants to rely on part-time seasonal jobs to make a living year-round. So there's always going to be a need to fill that void. This is what I've been arguing with my colleagues in the labor movement and other advocates, that not everybody wants to come and immigrate to the United States. They want to come here and work and go back to and build their families in Mexico or other Latin American countries. So there has to be some kind of balance here. But the most important thing is that the people at the bottom, the agricultural workers, need the freedom of association. They need to create the necessary tensions to negotiate transitions, technological change that affects their lives and their families. There has to be that tension. And I'm afraid that this issue is not going to really get addressed in immigration reform until we come up with a realistic foreign and trade policies that keep people from migrating and create some kind of stability of people to be able to make and earn a living with the current realities we have in agriculture. So there's a lot to be said about this.
Danielle Paquette, are these machines affordable for you know, your rank and file farmers, or is it something that the big corporate farm operations are able to avail themselves of more often?
So down in Florida, the company that's developing the strawberry picking machine, Harvest Crew Robotics, are fully aware of how tough that expense dilemma is. You know, smaller farmers can't afford to buy these big machines. So what they're doing, their business model is they're going to charge everyone the same price to rent out this technology and charge them by the number of strawberries it ends up picking. So they say at the end of the day, it'll be the same cost they pay for these seasonal farm worker crews. Their costs won't go up at all. They will just have this technology that doesn't need a visa or to sleep or ever need to take a sick day.
But they can break down.
That's right. And that's one of the challenges. Can this thing work through the heat? Can this thing work in the dark? Can it work in the rain? So they're working these things out. But the ultimate goal, you know, the researchers down in Florida told me, we're at a cell phone in the 80s level of something of how something can work, but we want to achieve smartphone status.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the mechanization of harvesting everything from strawberries to tomatoes. And with Danielle Paquette, she's a Washington Post labor reporter. She wrote about how they're developing machines down in Florida. Researchers are working on machines that can pick strawberries. Also with us, Baldemar Velasquez. He's president of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee in Toledo. Baldemar, I mean, how much has your workforce already been affected by mechanization? You said you represent 10,000 people. Is that a high, or where does that? You've been in the business for a long time. Where are things standing now?
Well, we've lost a lot of agriculture in northern Ohio. It's not like the 60s or the 70s.
With the tomatoes, yeah.
With the tomatoes, that's been transitioned out. They get that mostly now from California and Sinaloa, Mexico. And because everything's that is boiled down into paste, they make all the tomato products from paste. Mm-hmm. And then we lost the cucumber industry for the most part. Because the shifting economic trade situation, we lost the cucumber industry to Canada. Now it's cheaper to hire low-wage workers in Canada than to grow them in northern Ohio with the cost that small farmers have. Mm-hmm. They're undercutting us. They used to undercut us in Mexico in tomatoes and cucumbers. So we've lost a lot through this. The mechanization hasn't really impacted the cucumbers over the years. They harvest the larger size, the slices and relish. They can do that by machine, but the delicate number one that fit whole in the jar, it's like strawberries. You have to handle them delicately, not bruise the skin. They can get more of that in Canada and Mexico now than get it in the U.S. So we're subjected to these trade policies more than anything, than most people. And so we're going to continue to lose jobs in the U.S. To Mexico and other sources because the economy is global now. It's just not regional and local like it was back in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. So we have to be organized to negotiate these transitions and changes. And I think that's the race we're running.
Danielle Paquette, when you talk about these machines, let's talk about the ones that are picking the strawberries or they're trying to train to pick strawberries. What are they? How big are they? How do they move between on a strawberry field? It's pretty narrow, isn't it?
Oh, totally. It was different from what I expected. You know, I thought I'd go down there and see a robot kind of delicately plucking strawberries. But to me, it just looked like a semi-truck trailer that was just moving slowly and horizontally. And underneath, there were 16 smaller robots that were just spinning furiously and kind of scooping these strawberries up. The way it's rolling, it's rolling so it doesn't crush the plants. The wheels are going between the rows. The arms are scooping them up, while you see all these flashing lights underneath because the robot is relying on camera eyes to show it where the fruit is within these dense plants. And it's really fascinating to watch.
Does it matter that a lot of strawberries are now harvested before they're ripe?
You know, this particular robot is programmed to pick them up when they are ripe. The machine is supposed to detect, is this thing ready? Then we'll get the ones out that are ready right then. The problem when I was there, you know, I was there during a demonstration day this month. The machine was supposed to prove that it could pick half of each, half the berries on each plant, but it ended up falling short of that goal because this year's harvest, the strawberries were just much bigger. and it was a little more clumsy because these berries were so much bigger. So it's just not quite there when it comes to figuring out what it's not perfectly programmed to pick. If it's a little bigger, a little smaller, you'll see those tumble.
You said that they get a little bit better every year. What's the trajectory here? Is there a sense of a timeline at this point?
Well, they were hoping that this machine could be ready for commercialization as soon as next year. It might be another year on top of that now. It's hard to say. But the farmers tell me that a human success rate is between, you know, 70% and 80%. So if they could get that robot up to 60% or 70% effective, it could be ready to go. But right now, it's still stuck below 50.
Baldemar Velasquez, what is it that you negotiate on behalf of the 10,000 workers that you represent? Where's your footing on this?
Well, most of those workers come with a work visa from Mexico, the H-2A visa.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have on the other farms that are not H-2A, we have a lot of undocumented workers. We have to protect their rights. They're human beings, been out working, doing stoop labor, and they should not get cheated of their wages. They should not be sexually harassed. They should not be discriminated against, retaliated against for speaking out. So that's what we do in our negotiated agreements. So we protect their jobs, their safety, their work conditions. And the guest workers from Mexico, we in our contract, they have the right to return. They have a seniority rights to come back and reclaim the jobs from the previous year. Unlike other guest workers who don't have a right to, the employer cannot bring, doesn't have to bring them every year. He can bring whoever he wants.
Mm-hmm.
But under our agreement, they have to pay attention to the longevity and the seniority rights of the people. And so we've stopped a lot of abuse in that regard and set some precedents in terms of this global issue, because our workers have a right to file grievances in Mexico over recruiting violations of the recruiters that work for the employers. And that's where a lot of the abuse starts, because a lot of them come indentured in this guest worker program. And one of our staff people got assassinated in Mexico for the campaigns that we've done to curb that abuse from the sending countries. So that's the stuff that we do.
But with the advent of mechanization, where's your leverage if and when this comes to pass?
Well, sensitive labor-intensive crops, there's crops that are not going to be mechanized in the near future. So there's still a labor void in that in those areas. And we have to, like I said, we're running a race to organize the people to negotiate the transitions and changes, because many farmers are looking to diversify themselves from one labor-intensive crop to another. So there's a lot of fruits and vegetables in the Carolinas, apart from tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to transition out of tobacco. And so there's still a lot of need for efforts to protect agricultural workers.
Danielle Paquette, is there concern at upper echelons of policymaking that this could, this is so terrible, that could upset the apple cart when it comes to labor balance for these commodities?
You know, I'm actually hearing a lot more focus on the opportunity it can bring.
Huh.
You know, I'm hearing, well, this could actually work out better for everyone because we have technology that could ultimately make it cheaper to harvest the fruit and the produce, but also create new kinds of jobs that pay better, that more people will want, that involve some technical training and computer skills that ultimately are better for the workers who, you know, as I keep hearing, are doing these super backbreaking jobs in the fields all day.
But would they be jobs for them, or would they be jobs for Americans?
That is a great question. I down in Florida, I asked that. And the farmer I talked to who's been investing in this technology said, you know, these seasonal workers know the lay of the land quite literally. Mm-hmm. They know all about this crop. And if we could train them up on using the technology, we think we'd be a lot better off and no one would really have to lose their job. The problem is there would just be a much smaller number of those kinds of jobs available. And also the workers I talked to who are out there picking strawberries said they don't really want to necessarily learn a new trade. They don't want to necessarily go to school and learn how to work with computers. This is what they've done. That's what they want to continue to do. So there is some tension there.
Yeah, and Baltimore Velasquez, I'll let you have that last word on this, but I just wonder, is this something that you're thinking about going forward, is retraining people and outfitting them for a different reality in 20 years?
Well, some, but we have to have an organization that can get people's attention to negotiate these things.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the other thing is that, no, a lot of our young people that in my generation growing up in the fields, we got our kids in the school. We got them to finish school and go to college and I'll learn another profession. Try to advance your life just like any other family.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to go in any direction we can to protect and grow the families that we represent and give them the best break in life.
Baltimore Velasquez, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's Baltimore Velasquez. He's president of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee in Toledo. And also Daniel Paquette of the Washington Post, labor reporter. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll have a link to Danielle's article about mechanization in farm labor. If you want, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. After years of rumors, Samsung introduced its first foldable smartphone, aptly named the Galaxy Fold. The phone boasts two displays and a host of other features, along with a roughly $2,000 price tag. With us to talk about that and more, Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Wow, $2,000, that's a lot of money.
It is, but you also have to keep in mind that this is a whole lot more than just a phone when you think about it. This is really kind of a phone and a tablet kind of meshed into one. And the way that this works is you kind of have a chunky phone that you would hold in your hand. It's a small screen that fits in your hand that you would use for, you know, kind of normal check your email kind of stuff. And then when you wanted to do something a little more, you could actually open that little notch on the side. And what you get is a much larger kind of square display that unfolds in front of you. It's really kind of bizarre to see at first.
So is it more mobile phone or more tablet?
I think that really is going to depend on how people use it. You know, I think we have a lot of people who use their phones as largely kind of Facebook machines where they're scrolling through social networking. And so for those kind of people, it probably would be a phone that has a larger screen. But if you are the kind of person who does, you're as much work as you can on your screen, people who would normally go and buy, say, a Galaxy Note and take advantage of the fact that you can run multiple applications side by side, or just someone who watches a lot of movies, TV shows from their phone and want to use that larger screen, then I feel like it would probably be more of a tablet that also did phone.
Does this larger screen, is that why there are so many cameras? There's six cameras on it?
Right. So there's two different sets of this three camera array, and it's the same three camera array that's on the back of the new Galaxy S10 series. And so you have a set of cameras for when the screen is open and a set of cameras for when the screen is closed. So if you want to use kind of the small, you know, phone shape and still want to grab a good picture of something, then you have that ability. But when you have the screen open and you have the larger display in front of you and you want to take, you know, the most expensive selfie you can imagine, then you then have that ability.
Does a folding screen affect the quality of the display?
That is a big question that we have yet to get a clear answer to. Samsung has been working on this flexible LED display for a while now, and they claim that that display is actually more impact resistant than most other devices that you would work with in this class. But it's covered in this material that is very different from the glass that we normally experience on phones. It's actually a plastic coating, and the plastic coating doesn't lay perfectly flat when the phone is completely open. You actually see and feel a crease in the plastic, which is a thing that a lot of people are kind of concerned about, because we've seen plastic phones in the past. They pick up scratches a lot more than glass displays do, and they pick up kind of scuffs and abrasions, and so they're not nearly as enjoyable to use after even 6 months or a year. I've learned from many Motorola phones that have the same kind of plastic coating, but also there's a lot of questions about how that plastic coating is going to hold up after just two straight years of opening and closing it every single day, multiple times a day. There's just not been a lot of hands-on testing to tell us what that's going to be. And so there's a whole class of people, you know, who are willing to spend $2,000 on this phone that are really going to be kind of global beta testers as far as this goes, because we've never really had a phone like this before.
Is this plastic coating something that could be removed and replaced?
I actually don't know the answer to that question.
Wait a minute. Let's just savor this moment.
That's right.
A question you don't know the answer to. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So historically, with glass displays that have been made over the last couple of years, they've actually been fused to the LED panel. So it's one piece with, let's say, your iPhone that you have right now. You know, that the glass and the display are actually one functional piece. So replacing them is actually quite difficult. It didn't used to be that way, but it is now. And so if it's the same way with these plastic displays, then it could be that a scratch on the display would actually be a very expensive replacement. Mm-hmm. But if it's not one piece, then it may actually be somewhat trivial by comparison.
When are you going to find out? When are you going to get to really use this thing?
This phone is not coming out until closer to the end of April, and Samsung has actually been really cagey about letting anybody touch this thing for more than a couple of seconds right now in its prototype stage. So we have not been able to spend nearly as much time with it as I would like before saying, you know, whether this is going to be a good idea for people. And we'll probably get a closer look at it, in the beginning of April.
And who do you think the demographic is here? Just somebody with money to burn?
Well, you know, there's always kind of what I call the early adopter tax when there's a new technology like this. You know, the Google Glass was $1,500, and you have goofballs like me who willingly put down money for it. But I feel like as a concept, this device is for people who are just very, very mobile and want that one device for everything. Samsung has been pushing in this direction for a little while now by making a phone that you could connect to a television screen or a larger monitor using software they call DeX. That gives you kind of that larger desktop format screen so that you can connect a keyboard and feel like you're sitting at an actual computer, even though it's all powered by your phone. To have the ability to go from the phone-sized device to the larger tablet-sized device, and then also to this thing that you can plug into a television and have that larger screen, it creates a single gadget that pretty much anybody who wants that one computer can functionally have. And when you think about it that way, $2,000 for one computer isn't really quite as crazy when you think about the phone that is normally $1,000 and the laptop that's usually $700 or $800.
Yeah, but I'd want to wait until they got the glitches worked out.
I absolutely agree with you there.
Said the non-early adopter. HoloLens? It's the second iteration of Microsoft's augmented reality headset. What's new?
A lot of stuff is new. It is lighter and thinner and running a much more faster processor, but it is still tremendously expensive, which seems to be the theme of our conversation today.
Yeah.
This is a computer. It's an entirely standalone computer that you wear on your head and can experience augmented reality in a total computing space. And what that means is you can You can reach out with your hand and interact with things without wearing special gloves or controllers. You can position screens in the real world that are only seen through augmented reality and actually leave the room. And when you come back with that headset on, the computer actually remembers where those things are in the room by scanning the room and recognizing the template that it had left before. And this has been Microsoft's vision for a little while now, is creating this kind of permanent sense of computing where the computer is something that is just kind of exists all around you.
Now, there's still people out there listening, I know, that are going, wait a minute, remind me, what's augmented reality and why do I care?
So augmented reality takes some computer vision technology and incorporates the real world with the digital world. So let's say my computer monitor as I'm sitting at my desk could be something that has my favorite website on it, and instead of having it be in a physical monitor that's sitting in front of me, it is actually floating in the air that I can only see when I put this special headset on.
What's the headset look like?
It looks like a Frisbee that has the hole cut in the middle of it with a pair of sunglasses glued to the top of it.
That's really good. So it looks weird.
It's an unusual headset. You're not going to walk around the grocery store with it. This is something that, you know, you're gonna pick up and put on, as you sit down at a desk or if you're working in an engineering environment and you're working in kind of a space with other people who are familiar with the technology. And this has been, one of the hurdles that Microsoft has run into with this. The previous version of this, the original set of HoloLens, was actually so heavy that it was kind of awkward to wear after, say, more than an hour. And they've actually done a lot to make it so that this is a headset that you could, in theory, wear for an entire workday and not be super uncomfortable.
And it's powered by a software called Snapdragon. What's the significance of that?
So Snapdragon is actually the name of the processor architecture.
Oh, okay,
so
sorry.
The chip that's inside of it. And this is Qualcomm has. This is the same kind of technology that you would find powering a phone. So essentially, the same kind of computing power that drives, let's say, the Galaxy S10 or a similar kind of new phone is also the computer powering this thing on your head.
Are you visualizing this, or is this like something that, as you mentioned, is mostly in a workplace environment, a factory, that kind of a thing?
Microsoft has made it pretty clear that this headset is geared towards enterprise environments. So engineers who are working, to build the next, engine or rocket or something, would be able to use this to kind of conceptualize it before they really did anything with it. And that's, a really interesting thing to see, car manufacturers that have worked with Microsoft in order to do prototypes and things like that. But this is definitely not the kind of thing that Microsoft expects people to buy and replace their desktop with or use in their living room or something, at least not right now. I'm sure that there is a point in the future where Microsoft would love that to be the case, but this is not the headset that they think is going to enter people's homes.
So would this be the sort of thing where people are standing around a table all looking at something that they're all seeing at the same time that's not really there?
That's exactly it. That is definitely a thing that has happened with HoloLens headsets already.
Okay. All right, now I get it. Okay. I just plugged that into all my sci-fi movie experiences, and now I understand. Now, you wanted to talk about the new phone from LG, the G8. It sounds kind of World Economic Forum-ish. What's new about this?
So LG has been working for quite a while now to compete with the likes of Samsung and Motorola when it comes to new phones that come out. They usually announce them at about the same time. And unfortunately, they don't get quite as much attention as Samsung or Motorola or HTC frequently do. And this year, their phone involves two pieces of really kind of bizarre technology that make it so that you can use the phone in really kind of interesting ways. The first is a unique new speaker setup where the display, the actual glass on the phone is actually part of the speaker, which is really kind of a weird thing to say out loud, but what it basically means is that you can make the phone louder by setting it down and letting the vibration system in the speaker actually go through the glass on your display to make more space for the speaker to be louder. So in effect, you create this kind of almost like a tiny boombox.
Yeah.
That you have in your phone, and all you're really doing is taking your normal phone and just setting it down somewhere where it can be flat and you know, let this technology happen. So if you are the kind of person who regularly takes their phone around their house and plays music on their phone while they're doing something, and you know, set it down and then complete a task in your house or outside or something, this feature is designed for that person.
Well, what's the quality like?
It's mixed. The speakers on phones are not particularly high quality, when compared to, say, stereo speakers.
Right.
And that's kind of the hurdle, right, is that it's not quite, it is certainly better than your average set of phone speakers, and it's certainly louder than your average set of phone speakers, but there's still this gap in between what this phone is capable of and, say, the bigger speaker that you would have in a Google Home or an Amazon, Echo or something like that, that are being sold as kind of these standalone home speakers mm-hmm. for this purpose.
Is the speaker what the Air Motion system is?
No.
That's
Air Motion
different.
Is its own. This is a really kind of fascinating other system. There's a set of cameras in the front of this phone. It's using a system called Time of Flight. In order to make sure that the reaction time between what the camera sees and what the processor is able to tell the computer is going on is super, super fast. And so in doing this, you actually have the ability to wave your finger over the screen and point at things without actually touching it and have the phone know that you are trying to make a decision on the phone. So you're trying to push a button or tap something. You're actually able to, from a distance of, say, maybe 6 inches to a foot, point at the phone and make gestures over the phone, wave your hand and things like that, and have the camera system pick that up and know that it means that you're trying to do something. So if you wanted to skip to the next track on the music player that you had, instead of having to pick the phone up and unlock the phone and go to the media player and hit the button, you could actually just wave your hand over the phone. And it would recognize that and make that make that change for you.
I know that we've come a long way since we had to get up and change the channel on the TV, but this is almost getting ridiculous. We're just going to be laying around like blobs because we never have to move anything anymore.
Well, and this is made all the more ridiculous by it being such a short distance. So it's not like you can be on the other side of the room and do this. The way that I equated this, when you combine the speaker system with this air gesture system, it felt almost like the target market was someone sitting poolside who didn't want to get water on their phone but still wanted to listen to music. So you were combining these features. It seemed like that was kind of the target market. But I haven't spent quite enough time with that to really kind of write it off. It's a neat concept. I'm eager to see, how LG has worked it into the entirety of the way the phone works.
And what about price? Who are they shooting for here?
This is going to start at around $800.
Oh.
And it's going to be available on contract, not on contract. It's going to be available, on monthly installments at most U.S. retailers.
Okay. And the camera itself is good?
LG has been doing really cool stuff with cameras for the last couple of years, including cameras that do lots of wide angle stuff that's a lot of fun. And this continues that tradition. So, yes, you can definitely expect to be able to do some interesting things with the camera on this phone.
Russell Holley, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holley, Android Central Contributing Editor. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.